Hello and welcome to another post-game edition of the Nittany Dispatch. I am John Sauber, Penn State beat writer for the Center Daily Times. She is Audrey Snyder, doing the same for The Athletic. And Audrey, it has been a day.
Has it, John? Has it been a day? It feels like it's been like 3 days.
I was going to say, it feels like it's been closer to a week, but yes, technically just the one day.
Yeah, Penn State pulls off the 33-30 win at the Coliseum in overtime. I mean, I don't even know where we start on this one. Usually, John, it's like, oh, here's a clear starting point. It's obvious where we want to jump in. I'm still remembering plays now that happened in the first quarter. And like, this is just the ultimate, like, mind-blowing game, because to me, it's about Penn State overcoming a lot of these narratives of winning a close game on the road as a ranked team that's in the top five. And then it's also like, oh yeah, that first half was like as bad as it could have been. So I don't know where we jump in, but Penn State gets the win.
I think we have to start with the actual result here, right? Like we'll talk about the what could have been, because it could have been very bad for Penn State. But before we get too deep into it, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Those 5-star ratings and reviews really help us out. If you're watching on YouTube, hit that thumbs up button down below. Hit the subscribe button as we continue that march to 2,000 subscribers. But no, this
march on, this, right?
Yeah. Okay. Enough of that. if this had gone differently, we would have started talking about the first half. But Penn State gets it together in the second half, right? They managed to pull off this win in what felt like a game that they usually lose, right? I think everyone saw that, right? It's usually James Franklin can't win the big game. They can't win on the road. They finally get top five and they lose. And all of those narratives, all of those little things, all of those little reasons they had to lose this game that usually happens in James Franklin's tenure as Penn State's head coach, didn't happen today. And I think that is important. And I think that's very valuable for this program right now.
Yeah. And I think too, another interesting note here is I think people maybe will see this and say, oh, well, Penn State beat an unranked USC team, blah, blah, blah.
It's a like, really good team.
Really good team, talented team. Also a team that was desperate. This was a team fighting for its playoff life. And I think that's a detail that should not get overlooked when we think back later on this year about Penn State's playoff resume and the ways in which they've won and how they got to 6-0 here at this midpoint of the season. Like, this was a USC team that looked really good. Like, to me, this was I'm looking at it and I'm like, their speed looks next level. Lincoln Riley's Lincoln Riley. I mean, he was scheming up some really good stuff, and first half was kind of taking Tom Allen's lunch money.
Yeah. But in the second half that stopped happening as often. Right. And I guess if we're going to start somewhere in the second half, we have to start with Andy Kotelnicki and the brilliance that is Andy Kotelnicki, right? Like, he is, I'm just going to fly right by that. He is, I would say, a top five play caller in all of college football on either side of the ball at this point. He is a brilliant play designer. He has told me before that he will take plays from anywhere. He's taken them from like low level Kansas high schools in the past. And today he ran stuff like, people will point to the trick play with Tyler Warren snapping the ball as an eligible receiver, running down the seam, catching a pass from Drew Aller after Aller got a backwards pass from
Double Beulah.
Yes, like, people will point to that specific play and be like, that's brilliant. It's not just that play. It's everything else they do. It's all the unbalanced lines. They come out in the monster package at one point with tackles split out wide on either side of the field with two eligible receivers. Like, they're just doing stuff that makes the defense wildly uncomfortable. And I think one of the things you saw, especially in the second half, and I thought this was true in the first half too, they were just missing like once or twice, and it would ruin a drive. But the USC defense looked completely lost at times. Like, Tyler Warren broke
wide open.
We haven't even mentioned this yet. He had 17 catches for, I think, 221 yards.
Yeah.
I don't know. Math is hard. I'll figure it out later. If you're listening to this podcast,
224 yards, 17, 224, targeted 20 times.
Yes. But like, he's being targeted constantly, yet USC continued to lose him, and they didn't lose him on purpose. They were trying to keep track of him. Andy Kotelnicki was designing stuff with the intention of getting him lost, right? I know there was one play, I think it was in the first half And I'm not being that big of a deal, I believe, but they run play action with Nick Singleton. He leaks out of the backfield and goes to a wheel route. Mm-hmm. And behind him comes Warren on a drag underneath. And yep. the defenders have to go with Singleton. Warren's wide open right there. And that's the kind of stuff that you just free up your best playmakers. You're putting them in position to succeed. And that's how Penn State won this game. They put their best player, who is Tyler Warren, in the better position to succeed than anyone else on the field on Saturday.
Yeah, it was absolutely ridiculous when you look at the way in which he was able to get wide open, especially in the second half, right? Because you see it play out. I remember tweeting something in the first half where it's like, yeah, Drew Aller has, I don't know, like maybe 15 pass attempts and 9 of them have gone to Tyler Warren. And it's like, okay, is this sustainable, right? We were kind of having this dialogue in the press box of like, can you run your offense through your tight end, right? Like, this sounds insane. And then they came out in the second half. And it was almost like they doubled down and were like, hey, yeah, watch us. We're going to do this, right? And I do want to go back to the double pass because for me, that moment, how Penn State came out and opened that second half, right, trailing 20-6 at halftime, it was bad. I mean, I think everybody in the fan base or most were seemingly down pretty bad, right? The narratives that we talked about earlier were starting to get drummed up, right? It was,
I mean, we were talking about it in the press box. Like, what are we going to write from this?
And this was all very valid. Like, I had for a hot second, I was like, okay, it's a bye week. I think I need to change my plans and not stay in California as long and like come back. And like, this is going to be a lot to sift through and like see kind of what maybe changes if they lose this game. But then they come out, right? And you see them march down the field and it looks like they're doing it with relative ease, which I think is also a sign of really good offense. And then you go to the double pass, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, what an absolute gutsy call, right? The fact that it's a 20-6 game, your offense you stalled out in the red zone in the first half twice. Now you come out, you go with this play, and I think that play is a perfect example of Andy Kotelnicki and this offense and what we heard after the game, which was players telling us, we wanted to be aggressive. Like, we knew coming into this, as Drew Aller said it, we had to empty the clip. That was the talk all week. And this was the particular play that they started repping UCLA week and saying, okay, like, when are we going to use this? We're going to have to use this at some point. And Andy told them at halftime, like, this is on our must-run list. We are running this play. And I get into it more in my story on The Athletic that should be up by the time that this podcast is in your feeds. But that play, there is so much to it and how Penn State has toyed it. It's a really, I think, a really good example of where this offense is kind of headed and how much trust Andy has in his players and how much they have in him.
And I think one of the things you said there that's interesting is you called it gutsy. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I view it that way, but more importantly, I don't know that Andy views it that way. I think he views it as, this is how we create advantages.
Right. Like, is this about John being like, oh, Andy, look at how we view things the same way.
No, but I'm just saying.
Absolute gutsy call, because if that doesn't work and say like that play does not work, I think you and I are then saying like, wow, this was a missed opportunity, right? And then people
see,
are clamoring about the Bo Pribula package. But hey, John, that's fine. You would not have even gone for game winning field goal because you don't believe in field goals regardless. So
We'll have that discussion. Don't worry. But no, I generally view the game that way, though, right? Like, I would rather you take those chances. If you fail at those chances, I think it's better than not trying those things, right? Like, I think he made the right call, whether it worked or not. The process is more important than the outcome in a lot of those situations and a lot of those decisions. And I think to the point I was making, like, I think he just views this as creating an advantage. I don't think he views it as a trick play, right? He's just doing stuff.
He believes in. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, sure. None of this to him is gimmicky or anything. Like, even the imbalanced or the unbalanced lines and everything, none of that is a gimmick. None of it's a trick play. It's just part of the offense. Mm-hmm. You know, they've run the unbalanced line stuff so much now that it truly is like a major part of the offense. And so that's why I say that I don't think he probably views it as a gutsy thing. I think he views it as this is the best play for this situation. Because they said specifically, mm-hmm. right, that they were going to run it as soon as they got to the past the 50 on the left hash. That was the plan, that they were going to run it. And so I think that's just, this is the situation that called for that play, right? They run a bunch of plays that get in certain situations. And I think that's more what it's about, that he's so creative. He's such an incredible play designer that what most people would see as gutsy or like this crazy trick play. To him, it's just another play in the playbook, right? Like, I think, and I think that's what part of the I guess the magic of Andy Kotelnicki is, right? For lack of a better term, is that he sees these incredible things he draws up as just part of the playbook.
He's got you under his spell, John. The magical spell of Andy.
Listen, I already said I don't think he'll be back next year because I think he'll have a chance to be head coach. And I already said that I think he's a top five play caller in the country.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, now you're going to give people a lot of things to worry about during the bye week. Great, John.
Enjoy the season.
I do think this is, to me, there were a lot of statements that were made in the second half. And one, you found a way to win on the road as a top five team. That is not something that we have seen go well for Penn State during James Franklin's tenure, right? Coming into Saturday, Penn State was 0-3 when ranked in the top five playing on the road, right? So you have that. Then it's also like, okay, this was a weird game from Drew Aller. Weird in that ultimately stat line throws three picks. One was a Hail Mary. We can kind of toss that one out.
Yes.
Throws two picks. I honestly thought at halftime you and I were going to be having a different conversation tonight, and one that was centered around, this is the same old Penn State, right? They can't win in the big moments. The quarterback looks like he did last year in some of these big moments. Instead, you come out, you start that opening, the second half, the opening drive with the touchdown that we just talked about. Then you come back and you score again. And the things that resonated with me were like, Drew Aller wasn't afraid to go to Julian Fleming again, right? Fleming has the pass interference, offensive pass interference penalty that you absolutely hated early
on. I think we may as well talk about this now. I think that's the wrong call. The defender initiates contact. We saw, I always have the TV broadcast on my laptop so I can see replays easier. They show an angle from like kind of, lack of a better term, angled from the end zone. And you can see that the defender initiates the contact and Fleming goes to swipe his hand away and kind of has some contact there as he's swiping away the guy who's already got his hands on him. And at that point, Tyler Warren's catching the pass and it's a touchdown. And like all the contact is kind of moot that happens after that. But because Julian Fleming was moving toward the defender and there was contact, the ref anticipated a foul that didn't happen, in my opinion, right? Like, I think the ref anticipated that because there was contact happening and Fleming was the one moving toward him, that therefore Fleming must have initiated contact. It's clear as day on the replay that the defender puts his hands up, initiates the contact with Fleming, and that there probably shouldn't have been an OPI called there. It happens. There were other bad calls in this game that went in Penn State's favor too. Like, this was not a one-off by any means. There was also another DPI that wasn't called on Tyler Warren. We got grabbed around the neck and before the ball gets there. That's catch number 18, presumably, that goes uncalled on that drive. So I'm not saying Penn State was at a massive disadvantage because of the refs, but I do think that particular play stood out as something like where, and I have this issue with officiating in all sports, where you cannot anticipate a foul occurring.
It's coming back to John and authority again, the conversation we had the other day.
That's John, not wrong.
Authority, John and officiating.
Yeah. But like this idea that you can't, you know, anticipate a foul occurring, right? Just because it looks like a pick play, if a pick doesn't happen, you can't call the foul. And I think that's what happened on that play.
Here's the good thing, John. I just gave you the form for that. None of it matters, right? Because thought we were going to be having a conversation about, like, here are all the ways that Penn State just lost this game, right? Same old Penn State. And then it wasn't that. And that was a little bit weird to see. And I think the fact that it's like, okay, there's the penalty on Fleming, comes out, then he also has a dropped pass. And talking with Julian after the game, he made it a point to say, and he very honestly and bluntly was like, hey, I was in my own head. And I've been in my head a little bit since last week. He said UCLA week, he did not have a particularly great practice. And he felt that kind of lingered a little bit. And so then he comes out, you have the penalty, you have the drop. And it's like, okay, I mean, I think it's easy to focus on the pressure and the stakes of the moment and the game. Let's also remember that Julian Fleming transferred to Penn State for a reason, right? And that reason is to get to the next level. And the stat line, we've talked about it enough. He's not going to put up the eye-popping stats, right? Like, it's all of his versatility, the blocking, these different ways that he's going to help you win games, right? The leadership, all these other things. But when Penn State needed Julian Fleming, it got Julian Fleming. And I was actually on my way down to the field. So Fleming ends up catching two crucial fourth down conversions in what ends up being the game tying drive late in the fourth quarter. I'm on my way down like the stands and you know, in the stadium. And all of a sudden, like you're in the elevator and you're like, I don't really know like how in the world this unfolded, but oh, it's fourth down. And I'm kind of pausing as I go down the steps and I see Allard look toward Fleming. I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go. Cause it has not been a good day at the office for Julian Fleming. And then he catches it. You're like, oh, okay. Like there is no lack of trust, lack of confidence. And then the fact that Drew Allard goes back to him, to me, that is again, so much of what we need to know about the offense and the trust piece, and that Drew Allard's going to go back to him. And Julian Fleming wants to be that guy in those moments. So I think you talk about trying to get him rolling a little bit. I think we saw that in huge, huge, massive way today.
Well, and I asked Julian, like, what went wrong on that drop, mm-hmm. like the egregious one. And he told me it was eye control. Like sometimes he just trusts his hands too much and he's not focused enough essentially on catching passes when they're getting in. He's tried to, the way he phrased it was retrain himself. And he's worked mm-hmm. on it like a lot. And he really emphasized how much he's worked on it. But the other thing is, you mentioned that he was kind of in his head a little bit. I asked him how important getting that first fourth down conversion was to getting the second one. Yeah. Right. Because there's no guarantee one that he gets either, obviously. But if he's in a low confidence place on the second one, the chances of that are probably a little lower than they would have been had he not caught the first one. And I thought his the quote he gave me was pretty telling. He said it built my confidence back up. Everybody wants that one that just builds the confidence back up. I think that was the one for me. I was kind of ready to go after that, especially after earlier in the game, not doing what I wanted to do. I think that really built my confidence. We passed the sticks and just kept going from there. Like it the way he spoke about it too, it was very clear that he kind of needed that first fourth down conversion to be able to get the second one, right? Like if that first one had maybe gone to someone else, then maybe the second one doesn't go that way. And what was really impressive, and Drew spoke about this post game too, Drew didn't really talk about this as much. Those are tight window throws. He does not have mm-hmm. a lot of room to make that throw. And Julian has a defender draped all over him. Mm-hmm. And he's making both of those catches in just vital, vital spots. One a fourth and seven, the other a fourth and 10. They go for 17 and 16 yards respectively. Like the biggest moments of the game for Penn State, I would argue bigger than the made field goal at the end, because you're kind of playing with house money at the field goal still. You have another overtime lingering potentially if you don't get it. If you don't get either of those fourth downs, the game is probably over mm-hmm. because USC needs one first down. They've been getting that with ease all game long. And so I think there's a chance we get to late November, early December, and we're looking back and like those are two of the biggest plays of the entire season for Penn State. And they're from someone who had just you mentioned the drop, but like there was also a ball where the ball got on him earlier than I think he anticipated mm-hmm. on the glance route, it kind of sailed above his head because he didn't have his head turned quickly enough. And so I think this is the moment that I think we're going to look at and say this is potentially where this offense really kicked it into high gear.
Yeah, and I hope fans remember that moment, right, at the end of the year, regardless of where this thing ends up. Who knows, right? We don't know. But I think people tend to get wrapped up in the stat lines and those types of things. At the end of the day, it's like these are your biggest moments, and Fleming delivered, right?
Let's take a brief break from the podcast to discuss our friends over at Roback. If you like this hat that I'm wearing right now, if you like most of the gear that I wear when we record this podcast, and frankly, that Audrey wears when we record this podcast, or if you see us on the field at Penn State games, you know, when we can go down on the field for the last 5 minutes, we're wearing our performance hoodies. I'm wearing the performance joggers, the performance shorts. You can get all of that over at roback.com. And if you have not ordered from Roback before, you can use code TND20 to get 20% off your first order. That's TND20 as in the Nittany Dispatch 20. And I got to tell you, Audrey, I can't say enough good things about Roback and what they put out there.
John, when I went to your hotel this morning to get in the Uber, you probably remember what I said first. I said, John, are you okay? You don't have your Roback hat.
That's true.
Is there a reason why you don't have your hat on? Yeah, I came around.
It got warm. I got, you know, I sweat, whatever. You got to put the hat on. It makes up for the whole
performance apparel. It helps, John.
Yes, genuinely it does. And I will be wearing a performance polo during the bye week when I go golf, because it is our bye week too. But if you would like any of that gear, you can go to roback.com and get it. And you can get 20% off your first order with code TND20. Now, back to the show.
I want to go back to something we touched on a little bit earlier, John. The Tyler Warren Mackey Award. They're going to do everything in their power to get this guy as many looks.
The Tyler Warren Heisman Award, apparently. Now they want the Heisman Trophy to go to the man.
Yeah, James Franklin did say after the game that he doesn't think Tyler Warren is just the best tight end in college football or most complete tight end in college football. He thinks he's like one of the best players in the country.
He probably is.
And you look at the stat lines, you're like, ooh, okay. Like, I do not think that any of us in our right minds thought we'd be talking about Tyler Warren in this light back in July. I mean, I think we both agreed that he's really talented tight end, and there was kind of more for Penn State to tap into, and with the creativity of the offense, like, there was a higher ceiling. But to get what they've gotten from him, John, is it sustainable, do you think? Why?
So I think this goes back to the Kota Winicki conversation, right? You have a play caller and a play designer who wants to get the ball in his best player's hands and is good at finding ways to do that. Listen, if he can do it 17 times and potentially more, because there are a couple more chances there that, like I mentioned, the DPI that didn't get called earlier. There was one drop by Warren, too, in tight coverage. Like, if you can force feed a guy 20 times and the defense still is losing him, not just like, oh, he's making ridiculous catches, they are losing him. I think if I were a Penn State fan, I would have all the faith in the world that Tyler Warren can be the focal point of this offense moving forward, at least of the passing game moving forward. And maybe there's got to be a little negativity here, but like, he kind of has to be, because outside of Fleming's two catches, like, Trey Wallace has been a little bit underwhelming. Amari Evans made a really nice catch, but like, just not a lot from the receiving.
Pulled up the stat lines here, John, and obviously Warren, as we touched on, 17 catches, 224 yards, and that 34-yard touchdown, targeted 20 times. Again, still, every time you see it and say it, it sounds absolutely ridiculous. Nick Singleton, 4 catches, 39 yards, the touchdown at the end of the regulation to tie the game. Trey Wallace, 3 for 53 with a long of 25. Liam Clifford, 3 for 26. Fleming, the 2 that we touched on, for 33. Amari Evans, 1. Katron Allen, 1. Yeah, I think maybe one of the other surprising or odd things to me is that like, and maybe it doesn't matter because you've got this great chess piece in Andy Kotelnicki, but like, the whole who's the wide receiver one, right? Like, that whole conversation, we're not having it because Tyler Warren is that and then some.
Yeah.
Right? It's just a different way to maybe think about it, but I do think you want to get some more production. And they did look Harrison Wallace's way in the end zone. I remember one time in particular.
The sluggo they ran on the double move to Wallace, where I didn't watch the replay a ton, admittedly, but I thought he probably could have hauled that pass in on the left end zone. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah,
the one
I couldn't tell
what you're talking about.
Ball was a little bit, if it's the same, a little bit far out in front of him, I haven't gotten a great look at it.
Yeah, it felt like one that he probably could have come down with. I'm not 100% certain on that. The one throw to Amari Evans, I think it was early in the game, by the way, by Drew Allert, was ridiculous. Like, the absolute laser that he threw at Evans right before the end zone, I thought was one of the best throws I've seen Allert make in his career. But to go back to Warren real quick, it's you know, I mentioned scheming it up and everything. That play they ran with him lining up at center and snapping the ball, he had no business making that catch. That one should have been DPI. Insane. Like, that was the defender is like pushing him, and he had to fight through him to go back and get the ball. I thought that one was funny. The USC defensive back like looked at the ref like he was gonna try and get a DPI call, but he was just like shrugged his shoulders and moved on. Like,
sure,
what are you
man.
Gonna do? Like, that's like, you just have to own it at that point. But yeah, I think Warren is the type of player you can scheme everything for. You can scheme the entire passing game around. And also, he's going to create stuff. He's that good. He's been that good pretty much all season. And he's wide receiver one, right? Like, it looks weird. It looks different. Probably not something Penn State fans are used to, because, you know, you see the Jahan Dotsons, even KJ Hamlers, like guys like that, that are playing either in the slot or on the outside and are not like these massive blockers as well in the running game. But he is their best receiving option right now.
And to me, that is like the it is weird and it is different. I think it's also a conversation for another day of, I might have even said this on our midweek episode of like, he is your most valuable player. I think I said that. Maybe.
I don't remember.
I think I did. And you were like, well, it'll be Aller. I think I might have. I'll have to go back and look. But I think there's a bit of a conversation of like, you take Tyler Warren out of this offense. I don't know what it looks like. And, you know, if you're Penn State, obviously you got to keep this guy healthy, bubble wrapped the rest of the way here, because you've got a lot going on with Tyler Warren and just a tremendous athlete. I mean, we've seen him do so many things, but yeah, it's like, okay, that touchdown catch is absolutely ridiculous. But oh yeah, we also saw that crazy sideline catch from him earlier this year. Like, the Tyler Warren highlight reel is going to be insane at the end of this year, and we're only halfway through it. So like, to me, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I think now we probably have to pivot to this defense and was a pretty bad performance in the first half. It goes beyond a slow start. It goes beyond like USC has a lead offense, which they do. Mm-hmm. It was a defense that didn't look like it knew what it was trying to be, I guess. Right. Like, they usually run a lot of the shell zone. Yeah. They're not trying to give up big plays. Well, they got gashed for a big play on USC's second drive.
Big old
first
plays.
Play mm-hmm. with they ran a jet sweep that was a fake reverse, and Quentin Joyner just takes it to the house because nobody's
home. It was
home.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I thought it was. I mean, listen, this Lincoln Riley's brilliant too, right? Like, that's we're talking about Kodo Nicky in the top five. Lincoln Riley's probably one of the few guys ahead of him. But it was still bad, and there were too many opportunities for them to make a play in the first half, or they just didn't. And I think that was my thing at the end of the first half. And I've said this before, that good offense beats good defense, and that's usually the case. And I thought that was going to be the case, in the second half too. But there was something about the defense in the first half, and I'm curious what it looked like when I rewatch it, that made me feel like they were not organized properly, right? That they were not being put in a good position to succeed, to the point that I wasn't necessarily blaming the players. I just thought it was a coaching failure, at least for the first half, before it became like a massive coaching success in the second half.
Yeah, we've seen so many of these lopsided performances from the defense this year that there is cause for pause. And I think when you go back and look at it, right? Like, you go back to that touchdown, and at one point early on, I think it was at maybe end of the first quarter, it's like, these guys are giving up like 60 an average, and again, the big runs change it, but like 16 yards a run. And you're looking at it, you're like, okay, this Penn State run defense suddenly has been gashed for 140 yards. And like, we've talked plenty about the linebacker play and what changes. And I wonder, John, does a first half performance like this, does it change your perception of Penn State going against Ohio State? Because that's what this year is about as much as anything. It's about these other top five programs, top 10 programs. And yes, USC was desperate. Yes, Lincoln Riley is brilliant. Yes, this is a crazy good test that Penn State ultimately passed, barely, but they passed it, and that matters a lot. But does that change your perception of maybe the expectations for this defense or the confidence you would have in it going into an Ohio State game?
No, because Miller Moss is a significantly better quarterback than Will Howard.
Oh, no. I teed you up for your Will Howard dislike. Yeah.
Listen, how the game ended today, but Miller Moss is really good at getting the ball out quickly, and that mm-hmm. takes advantage of this Penn State defense. Now, there's the Lincoln Riley of it all. Chip Kelly's also a good play designer and play caller, but I think we saw against Oregon that Will Howard is not necessarily the guy that you can trust to win those games. He's relying on Jeremiah Smith. He's relying on the running game. He's relying on the weapons on the outside to make those plays. And you know, you feel for the kid with the way that game ended, because he just kind of lost it a little bit and slides down, and the clock runs out, and Ohio State loses to Oregon. But at the end of the day, like, he's too veteran of a quarterback to make that decision, for that to happen. And so I think that's what this comes down to. I think this whole time when I've said that I thought Penn State had a better chance against Ohio State than people thought, it was about Will Howard. And it was about what the Ohio State offense is going to look like. There were a few cracks in the foundation for the Ohio State defense today too, right? Like I think, you know, Penn State's not Oregon, but they have a very creative play caller like Will Stein is for Oregon. So I don't know. I think that is going to be a really close game. And sometimes home field is all that matters. And that can be the difference maker. And I think it could swing. So no, to go back to the original question, this really doesn't change how I feel about that. The other part of that is I still think AJ Harris is really good. I still think Jalen Kimber's good. I still think like a lot of, they have really good depth at corner in a way that they should be able to not, they're not going to shut down Jeremiah Smith and Emeka Egbuga, but they have a chance to limit them. And I think that's really important in that game. And, you know, this defense is designed, talk about the shell that they play in the way they play zone. It's designed to kind of let you get down the field and then you make a mistake eventually and either you have to punt or you turn the ball over. Will Howard's more prone to making those mistakes than Miller Moss is.
Do you have anything else to say about Will Howard? Are you going to
anything
else to back over him?
Listen, I said, I feel bad
for my hometown, John. Yeah. And this, yeah,
I really do feel bad for him. That's a bad way for that game to end. They'll make the playoff. Yeah. Ohio State's going to be fine, but you feel for the kid in that situation, that game ending that way.
I'm sure none of our listeners are feeling that way, John. Oh,
I'm certain they aren't.
Yeah. I'm willing to wager on that one. To me, there's just this, these kind of oddities of, you mentioned, like, it's not just the slow start, but seemingly they can kind of turn it on and off, which is a little odd to me. But when you need them, they step up, right? And at the end, so at the end of the game, and you and I, we haven't talked about this yet, but when Nick Singleton scores the touchdown late in regulation to tie the game, did you think at that moment, honestly, that Penn State was going to win that game?
Yes, because I thought they were going to go for two. So
I thought they were going to go for two as well. I am totally with you.
I would have there because I would not have trusted the defense in that spot.
I was really surprised because we were on different parts of the field, and in my head the whole time I'm thinking, okay, they're going to score and they're going to be gutsy enough to go for two because that's the way this game has played out. And like,
I thought they
should chance here, and I'm thinking like, okay, they're going to scheme something up. Again, for Tyler Warren, right? How original of me. And then they bring Ryan Barker out. I'm like, ooh, you're giving Miller Moss a good chunk of time here. Like, they just need a field goal, and they're walking it off.
I think what we didn't account for is that for all of the issue, or for all of the greatness of Lincoln Riley, the play designer and the play caller, Lincoln Riley, the game manager, could use a little work. The little Sean McVay in them in that sense, and Kyle Shanahan too. Those NFL coaches that are great offensive minds who didn't play enough Madden to know when to take a timeout and when to not use a timeout in situations. I thought that's when USC gave the game away. The way they handled their last drive, that just mind blowing to me that they did not push it more. That they were content, like, okay, it's third and whatever, like. We either get the first down here or we're in field goal range, like, and that's it. Like, I thought that was horribly mismanaged. And you're sending a message to your team there too that you don't have enough faith in them to you know, the defense can stop the Penn State offense if you need them to. You're playing for overtime in a home game where you're kind of teetering on the edge of losing it after Penn State came back. And by the way, the crowd was like far closer to a 50-50 split than I think USC fans would like to admit. Yeah. But like, I thought that's where USC lost it. So to answer the question, I thought Penn State was going to win because I thought they were going to go for two. But I also did think like that USC had kind of lost control of the game at that point. And that, you know, the USC offense, for as good as it was, like I said it before, like, I don't believe in momentum, but I believe in confidence. And once you lose that confidence, like, it all can go away really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, Penn State had captured that momentum, captured that confidence, the offense in the second half. And I think John loves those words. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it now, third and sixth, Penn State 45. That's when Miller Moss is picked off by Jalen Reed. And gosh, can you imagine, John, the conversation we would have been having had Penn State gone for two and then it not worked? Like, I think knowing you and I, we would have said, hey, it was the right decision. The execution lacked, right?
I would have died on that sword. I'm confident of that, because I think
they would have had a sword available, John.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, like I, again, it's to me, it's about the process. I also thought Penn State, and we are not having this discussion because it did not turn out to be a bad thing, but I thought Penn State was far too passive in the first half too. I thought they should have been going for it more occasions when they didn't. Namely, I think they're on their own 44, their own 42, and it was like fourth and three. And they were down, and I was like, listen, your defense is having a hard time. You're really going to put them back out there and give up another drive. And I think that's when USC scored the touchdown, their second touchdown of the game. It was just one of those situations where I think more aggressiveness would have helped, which leads me to your comment about me saying kickers don't matter. I will flip this on you. The reason you don't want your kicker ever having to kick a field goal is because you can easily be USC in this situation where you did not do enough in overtime. You resorted to the field goal and your kicker did what college kickers do. Like it happens all the time. I think it happened in, I actually think Pitt.
Yeah, but that's
today.
That's also, I mean, that's on the offense as well. Like that's not just went for the field goal and you didn't miss, like, and you missed it. Like that's your drive was absolute garbage. Yeah.
This is my point though. Like keep going, like keep pushing it offensively.
Put more garbage out there is what you're saying. Cause you
know, the offense, the offense was partially garbage because Lincoln essentially told him he didn't have faith in them late in the game, which
but you believe in confidence, but not momentum. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because momentum's a made up thing. But no, I like you can, the reason, and I thought Penn State made the wrong decision and it didn't end up mattering, but I thought it was the wrong decision to run it as often as they did in overtime, right? Like I thought those overtime runs where they were begging for a kicker to miss a field goal. And they were fortunate. Ryan Barker did a great job and he made the kick that he needed to. But again, you have a chance to end the game. And James was right when he said post game that you want to end it with a touchdown there, but you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you're out of field goal range. Well, you have to trust Drew Aller, as he successfully did all game, to not get sacked. And to get rid of the ball if he has to.
Not get sacked, but those, I mean, also you have the picks too. I think that maybe that is a little bit in their head a bit. Yeah, I mean, you get pass. Like, I think
you have to trust your quarterback in that situation to make the right decisions. You have to tell him, no tight window throws here. You do not need to trust your arm strength. If someone is open, you throw the ball to them. Otherwise, live to see another down. You have
retrain
to trust
your quarterback
enough.
Right then and there.
You have to trust him to be able to play like that when he needs to and to be smart enough, which he is, like we all know that he is, to play like that. And I genuinely think that Drew would have handled it well. Maybe they settle for the field goal anyways. But, like, you are inviting so many issues when you just decide to run it three times and concede that you're going to try and kick a field goal to win it. College kickers miss all the time.
Except Ryan Barker did not on Saturday, right?
And by the way, great for him. It was phenomenal. Yes.
Yeah. You're trying to take away the kid's moment, John.
No, I'm not.
I'm
not trying to take away his moment. I'm just like, again, I think it happened to Pitt. There was another game today, I can't remember, where it was to Pitt's benefit for what it's worth against Cal. But there were
again,
several
our listeners
today.
Are getting mad listening to you mention these
everybody.
Other teams, John.
But like college kickers miss those field goals way too often. And you just like... And Penn State had the data to go with Sander Sahidek as their main kicker prior to last week, and he couldn't hit from 40 yards. And all of the data pointed to him being the better kicker. And so it's just tough for me to put it all on someone's shoulders who hadn't done it a ton before, who was a walk-on, right? Like who is you're kind of not putting him in a bad spot, but you are making this a difficult thing when it doesn't have to be. And all the credit in the world to Ryan Barker. He deserves to be praised. He made all of his field goal attempts. He proved today that he can be a consistent kicker when they need him to. I just think the way that you handle that situation, you're inviting too many issues, I guess is the best way to put it, that I don't think have to be there.
Yeah. And Sander Sahidek did not even make the travel roster today.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
So I think that tells you like where this is headed, right? Like Ryan Barker is definitely your kicker. Like there is no,
the only kicker that traveled either.
Yeah, well, because Nwosu does kickoffs.
No, and then Chase Meyer traveled, I believe. Did he?
Did he as well? I don't recall.
This is a time where I wish I had my travel roster in front of me.
I was gonna say, where's my travel roster?
It's around here somewhere. I believe he traveled though, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that
maybe
is,
I'm wrong. I don't
that's
know.
The I, yeah. I mean, I know that Sander did not travel, But I think that's the piece to this as well, where you look at and you say, okay, like, we had so many questions about kicking, and I was asking James Franklin about the data and, you know, in games versus practices, and maybe Ryan Barker is a little bit more of just a big game guy, right? Where it seemed like from what we saw from Sanders Hayek that apparently he was much better in practices, but then we'd see it in games and it was like, not the case. So yeah, I think it was a huge moment for Ryan Barker. You and I are both down on the field at the end.
It's an awesome moment. The kind of thing say, that like, you really cool remember moment forever. For him. Yes.
Yeah. Like that is, that's a moment that Ryan Barker, his family, these players are going to remember for a very long time.
Penn State fans will remember if the season goes down, like mm-hmm. we think it can, like he will be like the, you know what I mean? The name that gets brought up, right. Is the guy who saved the USC game.
Right. It's why we talk about Irv Charles and right. And some of these other moments, right? Like you think back to some of these where people will say are probably obscure moments, but Penn State fans and people who cover the team around the team, like you remember those things. Mm-hmm. And same thing, like the Fleming catches, those are those moments. And for me, this was a day that Penn State met the moment. And I did not think that was going to be the case when they were down 20-6. And it's like, okay, this is about as bad as it can get for them. And then I'm thinking, no, don't tweet that because it can always get worse. Good thing I didn't because then there was another interception. But I mean, I think we learned about kind of the metal of this team and how it responds because sure, like we've seen them had to, you know, play from behind when you're dealing with Illinois or when Bowling Green comes out and punches first. But to me, it's like, and USC went down the field that 70 or 75 yard touchdown. It's like, this is going to be a ball game. And I haven't tweeted it. I was like, this is going to be, and I think I said it was a fun game and Penn State fans are like, what's fun about this? This is agony. Like that. I was like, I'm sorry. Like I meant fun for me, like hell for everyone else. Right. Yeah. Which you kind of forget that. Cause I was like, yeah, if that was me and my Packers fandom, I'd be losing it right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think this is, we learned a lot today about this team and be pushed forward into this critical stretch of the season and into a playoff push. And the fact that now it's like, okay, not only do we think you're going to get in the playoff, but now we're talking about like the likelihood of hosting is still very much in play, right?
And playing for a Big Ten title is in play.
Yes. And boy, oh boy, Penn State hits this idle week this weekend. And then we say, okay, there's a trip to Wisconsin. Like you're going to have some slip up potential there. No doubt you're on the road.
Wisconsin who destroyed Rutgers on the road today.
I was going to say like it's a weird time. Then you look Minnesota again, which I didn't even realize until this morning that they were also playing out here today, playing UCLA. They come back, they win. They pull.
I was
going
to say, I could not believe that they won that game because I thought UCLA was destined to win it after how all of this went. But no, I think you make a good point. I think we can get into a lot of that bigger picture stuff. That's what the bye week is here for during the midweek pod. I do want to say real quick before we close it out, because I've been usually the first to kind of cast blame on others when Drew Aller plays poorly. That poor start was on him. Like he played bad. Like the two interceptions, the real interceptions, not the Hail Mary.
Yeah, the Hail Mary.
Like, those were bad throws, and they're decisions that he cannot make, and they're throws that he cannot make in a situation where you're putting the team in a bad situation. So I want to be clear, like he pulled them out of the hole, but he also helped put them in it. And I think that is something that they have to get cleaned up before Ohio State, because that defense is not going to be forgiving at all. And they have the offense for, you know, my knocking Will Howard all I will, like their offense is still like elite because of all the talent there. So I do think he's got to improve over these next couple weeks. I'm sure that he will. I think Penn State's offense is in a really good spot going into the bye week. We saw him improve during the game. But I think this is probably a good place to leave it.
I wanted to get your thoughts on something else quick, just about Coliseum in general, your impressions of it. Obviously, first time out here.
That was so
checking
cool.
it out. I thought it was awesome.
I love the stadium. The torch at the one end of the end zone, I thought was really cool.
They lit it in the fourth quarter. That was cool.
Yeah. I mean, just like no one cares about our experiences out in Los Angeles.
No,
for the most
I think
part,
they do. Because if you're a Penn State fan and you're going to, if you want to come out here,
I'll say this. Yes.
Care.
I think in 4 years when Penn State returns to USC, maybe they flip the cycle next time. Who knows?
We can get a bunch of new Big Ten teams from now.
Yeah. Right? When Penn State's playing the Chicago Bears in 2029, I think. But no, I
no
think.
No comment for me.
Yeah, no, true. I almost baited you into that one. But I think this is absolutely a trip fans should make. They'll play at the Rose Bowl next year when they play UCLA, yeah. And fans have seen that before a little bit. But I think the Coliseum is it really is unique. It was one of the coolest away stadiums I've been to. I think it's the coolest, off the top of my head, the coolest stadium I've been to covering college football.
It's awesome. I thought it would be really neat, and it totally was even even mind blowing than that for me. And it helped that it was a 75 degree day, and yes. Then eventually the fog lifted. So it was, wasn't as hazy. So 75, sunny, and it was warm down on the field at the end of the game. Open air press box for us, which was awesome, because you're man, you feel like you're in Southern California. You can spot vaguely the Hollywood sign off in the distance. And then once that haze disappeared, I was like, oh yeah, I guess that's kind of the skyline that we're supposed to be able to see,
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really awesome. And as we figured they would, based off of what we've seen out here in LA the last couple of days, there were a lot of Penn State fans at this game.
Yeah, credit to Penn State fans. They showed up. It felt like a 55-45 split maybe in USC's favor. But that was from what I could see.
In big moments,
it felt like a neutral site bowl game. You know yes. what I mean? It felt like in big moments that Penn State fans were loud when USC was on the field. When I was down there, at least toward the end of the game, when USC's offense was out there, I heard a lot of Penn State fans, right? And when Penn State's offense, I heard a lot of USC fans. It was strange. I did not expect this. It's across the country. You know what I mean?
Usually
this can happen at Rutgers or Maryland.
But I think some of it might be right. Maybe they have one of the bigger alumni chapters, right? Maybe a lot of Penn State people have just kind of migrated out here. They live out here.
I wrote about this. You can read it over at centerdaily.com. The Penn State Los Angeles alumni chapter actually had about 1,000 tickets that they sold. They got as a group deal. So 1,000 tickets went to just that aspect of that group, it. That's not including fans or whatever. That's just the alumni association chapter. And so I think that obviously played a role in this, but yeah, it was awesome. It was, I don't know that we'll ever see anything like it in a venue that we go to.
Well, here's my one suggestion that they're not asking for, but that I will provide if I'm the Coliseum.
You never.
Holy cow, get your video boards fixed. It was like I was watching a movie. And I'm thinking I made the joke to Mark Brennan and Daniel Gallen, who were sitting next to me, and Johnny McGonigal on the other side. I said, do they just put Charlie Chaplin films on here? This is old school, black and white. It looked bad. I did not expect.
You're talking about the one to the left.
The big one.
Yeah, I thought it was terrible. It was pixelated. Horrible. You could barely see anything. I don't know what's going on there, but yes, it was really bad. But now that we're into video board conversation,
we're totally off track.
If you want to read my coverage of the game and everything else that came with it, I've got, I think, three stories. By the time this podcast is up, probably three stories up, potentially a fourth, over at centerdaily.com. You can find me on Twitter at John Sauber. You can find Audrey's writing from the game. She's doing excellent work, as always, over at The Athletic. You can find her on Twitter at oddsnyder4. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, those 5-star ratings really help us out. If you're watching on YouTube, hit the thumbs up button down below. Hit the subscribe button. We will get to those 2,000 subscribers soon enough, and then I will be asking for 3,000. So you may as well get us to 2,000 now, so I can just switch.
Pushes on.
I know. You got to just keep moving forward. But that'll do it for this episode. We will be back midweek during the bye week to talk about some of this big picture stuff, where Penn State is as a program, what everything looks like moving forward. For now, Penn State fans should enjoy this win and everything that came with it. But thank you for tuning in. Have a great day.